See if I can have enough voice left. As I indicated before, the first half of the chapter is on observing reason. It has six parts. First, nature in general. Second, organic nature or biology. Third, logic. Logic here is a purely formal inquiry into the forms of thought. Fourth, psychology, as an inquiry into active consciousness, insofar as it shapes the world and is shaped by the world. Fifth, physiognomy, and finally, phrenology. When I get to talk about physiognomy and phrenology, I am still in love with a short essay by Alistair MacIntyre that's collected in the Stewart Phenomenology of Spirit Reader called Hegel on Faces and Skulls. It's a terrific little essay. So the first half of the chapter, Observing Reason, concerns reason's attempt to intuit itself as actuality and find itself presently out there as shape and as thing, which is to say that reason cannot be satisfied with the mere mechanisms of the understanding. It wants to see that understanding exemplified in the structure of the world, and that finding itself everywhere in the world in accordance with pure reason is, we would now think of, as the project of a wholly naturalistic conception of man and world. So in a way, all of these are a kind of version of a kind of generalized naturalism. I'm going to give it as Columbian version of what philosophy should be. In general, the idea is that reason can come to feel at home in the world through the successful pursuit of scientific knowledge, by which the behavior of individuals is subsumed under categories and universal laws. So it holds generally to a mechanistic, law-like conception of reality, although the laws operate at various levels and for various types of objects, and that will make a difference, as we see. In paragraph 241, Hegel anticipates an obvious problem, which is also going to be the conclusion of the chapter of Observing Reason, namely that in mastering nature, reason meets itself as thing and not as self, and indeed as a static, non-historical, non-spiritual thing, hence as a skull. Phrenology is holding the truth between the relation between mind and world, just as nowadays people would say neuroscience. And it's not an accident that we should have disciplines now like neurophilosophy, right? That takes the science of the brain as the way of doing philosophy, which is what makes the section on and McNamara is aware of this, the chapters on physiognomy and phrenology, although clearly dated in one way, absolutely relevant in another. And I'll say more about that when we get there, that he's really attacking those reductionist programs. Or, as I'll want to put the point when we get there, that when reason treats itself as thing, it meets itself as already dead. But this is no accident. Since what will finally be at issue here is the inadequacy of theoretical reason for comprehending us as practical and socio-historical beings. Let me indulge myself. I was just thinking about this, but I decided I'll indulge myself earlier rather than later. And give an anticipation of that conclusion, not by looking at Hegel, but by looking at what, you just have to tolerate this, by looking at what's been obsessing me recently, namely W.G. Zabel's novel, The Rings of Saturn. And the opening section of The Rings of Saturn is exactly on the problem that we are examining. And I want to say a word about that, because if I was forced to it, or one of the things I'm tempted to say is Zabold is trying to write a post-Holocaust phenomenology of mind. That's certainly one way of reading Zabold. A Natural History of Destruction, right? That's one of the titles of one of his books. Well, I won't go through the complicated series of things that happen in the first four or five pages, except that Zabel is interested, for various reasons, in Sir Thomas Brown, and had been told that the skull of Thomas Brown was in the very hospital where he had been taken after having a nervous breakdown. And in after recording this fact, Zabel suddenly says that in January 1632, while Brown was in Amsterdam pursuing his own studies of the human body, there took place the public dissection of one Adrian Andriessen Zoon, also known as Eris Kent, who was a petty thief of the city of Amsterdam, who had been hanged for misdemeanors an hour or so earlier. Now, this sounds puzzling, but you actually all know about this already, because this is the dissection that is recorded in Rembrandt's great painting, The Anatomy Lesson. Do you all know that painting? Okay. So, of Dr. Tulp dissecting the arm, right, of Audrey's kid. Now, Zabel draws our attention to two features of the painting. First, that Dr. Toop's colleagues are looking not at the dissected arm of Kins, but rather, if you remember the observers, they're not looking down, but they're looking out. And what they're looking at the end of Kin's feet is, I think we're meant to assume, an open anatomical atlas in which, I'm quoting Zabel now, the appalling facts are reduced to a diagram, a schematic plan of the human being, such as envisaged by the enthusiastic amateur anatomist Rene Descartes, who, there is reasonable evidence to assume, was actually there in the Vag Bavau that morning attending that dissection. I won't tell you how I know that. Second, after noting the oddity of the fact that the dissection is beginning with the offending hand, which is an odd place to begin a dissection, usually you begin a dissection by taking out the intestines, getting rid of all the sloppy stuff, and only getting to the musculature and stuff later. Ignoring that, Zabel notes how grotesquely out of proportion the dissected hand is compared to the closed one, compared to the undissected one closer to us, and further how anatomically the wrong way around it is. He says the exposed tendons, which ought to be those of the left palm, given the position of the thumb, are in fact those of the back of the right hand, which leads to the inference that Rembrandt had transposed a diagram from presumably that same anatomical atlas. Zabold finds it inconceivable that this flaw was not intended. He says the unshapely hand signifies the violence that has been done to Aris Kint. It is with him the victim, and not the guild that gave Rembrandt his commission, that the painter identifies. His gaze alone is free of Cartesian rigidity. He alone sees the greenish annihilated body, and he alone sees the shadow in the half-open mouth over the dead man's eyes. Zabel places Descartes in the operating theater and hypothesizes that the anatomical atlas is of the kind that Descartes had envisaged. And I take it he does so for the sake of contrasting, let's say it, the realism of science and the realism of art. That there is a more than categorical or casual fierceness to Zabel's critique of Cartesianism. He says the following. In his philosophical investigation, which form one of the principal chapters in the history of subjection, Descartes teaches that one should disregard the flesh, which is beyond our comprehension, and attend to the machine within, to what can be fully understood, be made wholly useful for work, and in the event of any fault, either repaired or discarded. Though the body is open to contemplation, it is in a sense excluded. Zabold is placing his narrative in the context of the tradition of Dutch realism, which he construes as determined not by verisimilitude, but by the quest for, as called, fidelity to the victim. Such realism must locate itself at the level of the flesh, at the level of actual bodies in their life and death, that is, not in the domain of the understanding, in which things can be mechanically grasped, controlled, subjected, repaired, or discarded. Dr. Tulp, this is me, not Zabold, is probing the flexor digitorum muscles here, of Kint's left hand. Now, the thing about these muscles is he's trying to demonstrate that if you pull them, the dead fingers of the hand may be made to curl. And if you remember the painting, with his own hand, Tulp is actually imitating that curl. And he's actually imitating what would happen if he pulled the flexor digitorum muscles. Now, the thought here is not only is it the case that Tulp is substituting his will for that of Kint, but the movement of the living is being understood, his own movement is being understood on the basis of the movement of the dead. So many, to use a Cartesian language, strings and pulleys and wires. So the will, and this is the thought that I think Hegel is going to be getting at, the will of science here that moves the dead hand, and hence the will of science that tells us how the hand moves, is a mimesis of the dead. So science takes its model of the living human being from the dead human being, and then transposes it back onto the living human being. This is Adorno's thought that Enlightenment rationalism is a mimesis of the dead. That is, you begin with the model of the thing, the dead thing, and use that as a way of modeling all reality. So that what makes scientism, naturalism, inappropriate is it begins with beings who are already dead, finds them comprehensible in their structure, and then projects it back onto the living. This is just the movement that leads Hegel to end the section on observing reason with a discussion of a skull as the true house or the thing that is the true correspondence of the scientific way of understanding rational beings. Well, let me try to look at least two or three of Hegel's arguments about how this is going to work out in his account. So the first section is on classification. And the thought that particulars can be understood by classifying them, by bringing them under natural laws. And that finally, classification and experimentation on their own prove themselves to be inadequate. And reason posits law-like relations. And that such laws are again taken to be fundamentally rational, not empirical. Hence, knowledge of at least physical nature, and here's the thought that Hegel is driving at, stands at some remove, indeed some massive remove, from empirical sensuous reality. That is, the problem of classification is it's an abstraction from concrete particulars in their sensuous character and a bringing them under those laws and therefore turns out to be at a great distance from their concrete physical reality. Now, what drives this is that, or what Hegel is interested in here in making this argument, is that the observer is moving through this various stages from classification into abstract laws because he is in search of an internal necessity to his practice. He wants to know not just that we can classify, but that it's rational to classify the world this way. Not the mere fact of it, but we want to see the internal necessity of our practices of science. And the problem is that physics does not and cannot demonstrate the actual existence of reason as warranted. Because, and here's the way I want to put it, because physics, whether in Hegel's time or in our own, can never demonstrate the internal necessity of its mode of explaining reality, it is always possible to offer a nominalist or instrumentalist or operationalist conception of physics. That is, for every claim that physics grasps reality how it truly is, there's someone else who's going to say, no. Physics is just an instrument we use to manipulate reality, or laws belong to the understanding, and the only thing that's really real are the entities themselves. It's kind of Nancy Cartwright's view. Bas von Franzen will say, right, it's just correlations at the instrumental level. Put another way, physics always needs philosophy to demonstrate not that it works, it obviously works, we send people to the moon, but that it's fully rational and internal to that philosophical reflection on physics, it always empties out into a debate between various schools of the understanding of science, some rationalists, some empiricists, and then some realists, and then some wildly nominalist ones. The reason this occurs, Hegel argues, is that the reason why physics will always be in this position is that physics will always be conditioned by the observer's approach to the world. That is, in some way, science always constitutes its object in a certain way, say as mathematizable. And secondly, that it will always be faced by the presence of variables and or matters and their relations. So physics is always going to to put it again in the most simple way, physics can always account for the world, but can never account for its relation to the world. That is, can never account for its own truthfulness. And therefore, in a certain sense, there is always, the rationality of physics is always shadowed by a kind of irrationality.
So Heisenberg kind of put Hegel in practice?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just what I was thinking as I was writing those notes. Yeah. That notion of conditionality shows that there's no, and of course he was arguing this particular notion of observation, but yeah, we are observing, by observing we constitute and therefore fracture it and therefore don't rationally comprehend it in itself. That's certainly one version of it.
But isn't that just to say again that genesis and validity never coincide?
Right. Well, in physics.
Okay.
I mean, what's going to... it's not going to be an accident. No. This is... remember, the question is how we best understand ourselves and our practices. And the claim here is not that there's anything wrong with science, it's that science, physics in this case, cannot be used as a transcendental, right, for understanding the world and itself. That the very nature of physics, as it were, makes it always a local phenomena and never a transcendental. So of course, if you're a crazy naturalist, you're going to try to get around this by various theories about reductionism. Right? I mean, reductionism is trying to, as it were, squeeze out all those remainders. But that's what's at stake in those practices. So his claim here is simply, and of course it makes, it's interesting that both in the 17th century. And then in our own, that physics was used as the universal science. I mean, after all, think about how Locke begins the inquiry. There have been these master builders, Newtons and so on. And what do? We underlabor. What does underlabor mean? We make the intelligibility accord with the results of physics. Exactly, Locke's project. We have to translate what knowledge means, everything perception means, so it is compatible with corpuscularianism and the laws of physics. So it will not be a surprise that physics fails. And he's going to say something similar about biology. So let me say a word about biology and we'll stop there.